will now call the Texas Department of Insurance, Division of Workers' Compensation versus Albertsons.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
Morning.
Justices, Mr. Richards. Your Honors, this case has a very long procedural history, but I think the relief that the Texas Department of Insurance Division of Workers' Comp is seeking is fairly simple. Our argument is that this court should reverse the judgment of the trial court with a determination that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to sign any of the judgments except for the first judgment that it signed on April 10th, 2003. The court, after signing that judgment, lost its plenary power to sign any further judgments on May 12th, 2003. So we're asking the court to consider just that. The only judgment in front of you is the judgment that the court signed on April 1st, 2008. We would argue that the court, for the reasons we've argued in the brief with regard to the other judgments, did not have jurisdiction to sign that judgment. I'll briefly go through some of the reasons my client takes the position it does. The first judgment, court did have plenary power. We were fine with that. The second judgment, which the court signed on October 4, 2004, was a judgment nunc pro tunc. And as I explained in the brief we presented to the court, that was not a proper judgment nunc pro tunc. It substantively changed the judgment. In fact, my sense is that opposing counsel accidentally submitted the wrong judgment to the court to sign. The judgment that they submitted to the court to sign found that there was no compensable injury sustained by the workers' comp claimant. The first judgment that they presented to the court, in which the court actually signed, found that there was a compensable injury, but no extent to certain parts of the claimant's spine. The third judgment was signed after my client informed the insurance carrier that the judgment nunc pro tunc was not proper. And as argued in the brief, we've argued that the court at that point did not have plenary power because we cited the Newsom v. Ballinger case where the court found that a judgment is void and final. And even if a judgment is void but final, the trial court still has to have some plenary power to declare it void.
I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
The judgment that you're saying is the final judgment, the April 10th, 2003, correct?
The judgment we're saying, yes, ma'am, that is the correct judgment.
And that's styled order on plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. And as you know, just because an order is entered on a summary judgment doesn't necessarily mean it's a final judgment unless it disposes of all parties and all issues. And this order doesn't award costs or anything like that. And so, and the pleadings, I'm sure, are in the clerk's record, but I haven't reviewed those yet. And I'm asking you if the summary judgment, the plaintiff's summary judgment, moved for summary judgment on all claims and all causes of action.
Yes, ma'am. I believe it does because it was a motion for summary judgment based on deemed admissions. The other side did not appear, although the other side did answer initially. Since the other side did not either answer the discovery or appear, the court was able to grant a motion for summary based on deemed admissions. And hence, I believe that did dispose of the substance before the court and resolve the dispute between the parties. Now, as the court will be no doubt aware, or Mr. Richards will inform the court, there is an underlying issue. The reason the carrier is seeking, has worked so hard to get a judgment from the district court is by presenting the subsequent injury fund, which is a fund administered by my client, with a final judgment, the carrier will be reimbursed for the benefits that they paid to the claimant. And my client's position is that they have not received a final judgment that binds the commission because the carrier did not comply with Section 410.258 of the Labor Code. Now, that is a big issue for the carrier, and my client understands that, but I don't believe this court needs to address that issue in its opinion regarding this case, because if this court were to determine that the April 1st, 2008 judgment should be reversed and explain its reasoning that only the first judgment is a final judgment, then the carrier would have the option to collaterally attack the first judgment. And the carrier has brought to the court's attention the Brooks case, which was decided by the Third Court of Appeals. And the carrier could argue that they did not have to follow Section 410.258 to begin with. Therefore, the judgment was both final and valid according to that section of the Labor Code. But I don't believe that issue is before the court. This dispute started before either party knew that the Brooke case was going to come out. And we were relying on the law, at least as my client understood it, the Ballinger v. Newsom case and other cases, which clearly instructed that a court cannot, just by being shown a statute, declare a judgment void unless that court has some power to declare the judgment void. Now, I do have arguments about why the Brooks case was wrongly decided, but again, unless the court wants to hear those, I'll spare the court those arguments. I think those arguments for a later day, probably in a declaratory judgment action in Travis County against the Division of Workers' Comp. So
why didn't the department challenge this second and third order or judgment by mandamus? Just curious. I mean, could have been it.
Well, Judge, I think that to set the record straight, my client did not have notice of the second judgment, the judgment nunc pro tunc. I realize the district court found that we did, but there's nothing in the record to indicate we did. My client has informed me that they did not receive notice of the judgment nunc pro tunc until they were informed that the carrier sought reimbursement under that judgment. Then when they sought the third judgment, that is when we determined we had to intervene and explain to the court why they could not enter the third judgment. Frankly, my expectation was when we appeared before Judge Rimmel that she was going to pick as the final judgment either the first judgment or the third judgment. I was not expecting her to determine that the judgment nunc pro tunc was the final judgment in the case. But we did not intervene because we did not know about that second judgment. So unless there are any further questions, I will sit down and let Mr. Richards present his views on the matter. But again, we're simply asking this court to find that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to enter any of the judgments except for the first, and we ask the court to reverse the order that the judge signed on April 1st, 2008. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hayburn. Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Your Honors, Mr. Hayburn. Obviously, I represent Albertsons in this case, and want to, I guess, start by giving you all a little background on how these cases get to where they are at this juncture. For years, and we've been doing this for years. We'll get a decision against us at the underlying workers' compensation level. We disagree with the decision, some aspect of it. We'll appeal it. The appeals panel does what they always do, which is rubber stamp it, whatever the hearing officer decided. So then we're left with the decision. Do we abide by it, or do we appeal it to district court? This particular case, the underlying decision was extent of injury and disability. We did not agree with it, so we filed in county court. What you need to know, there's a lot of things that take place in these cases that are going to be outside the court's record. For instance, when we file the lawsuit, we're required by law to simultaneously file it with the executive director of the division. That's done. That's not part of your record, but I assure you it was done, because the law says it's not actually a jurisdictional requirement, but it says it is a requirement. We always do it. We receive a file stamp copy back, place it in our file. So that's done simultaneously. That gives the commissioner notice that a lawsuit's been filed. That gives them the opportunity to intervene in this case if they think we're somehow trying to pull one over on a claimant, hoping to get a default, something of that nature. Defaults do happen. I'll be the first to admit that. But defaults aren't reimbursable. Default basically means that we could suspend benefits that were ongoing or whatever other issues there might be under the case. In this case, we filed it with the court. We filed it with the division. We are also required, not required, but we do send a proposed judgment to the commission. Now, that's also not going to be in your record because it's not sent to the court, the file stamp copy, but it's in my file. File stamp, proposed judgment. In this case, the proposed judgment was identical to the judgment entered in 2003, save and except for the fact that it said claimant did not appear and wholly made default, because we don't know what's going to happen when we file that. We don't know if they're going to answer, what they're going to do, if they're going to hire an attorney, if they're going to answer. So we couch the first judgment as a proposed judgment, which is a default. Now, a default in this case wouldn't have done us any good. We were glad she answered because, again, a default does not allow us to go to the subsequent injury fund and get our money back by law. So we were happy. She answered. We proceeded with our normal course of litigation, filed for admissions, got the admissions, got the summary judgment. What we didn't do, and Brooks says we never have to do, but Brooks wasn't in law back then. Brooks says this was an adjudicated case. You didn't get this by agreement. I didn't sit down with Ms. Horn, the underlying claimant, saying, okay, if you don't show up in court or answer these admissions, we'll continue paying benefits, something underhanded like that. We did it strictly by the numbers. It was adjudicated. We prepared the order. The judge signed the order. It disposed of all issues. Justice Case, I believe you asked if, or somebody asked if that was a final, disposing of all issues. It did for our purposes. We then took that judgment, or that order, and I put together a package, and I sent it to the subsequent injury fund, and saying we're requesting reimbursement to the tune of about $60,000 on this case. They said no. And they basically, in conversations with Mr. Haburn at that point, I determined that their reading of this statute, and all this has been coming about on a number of different cases, is, well, you know what? You didn't send us that actual judgment. Yeah, you got a proposed judgment that said default, but you didn't send us that identical judgment 30 days before it was entered. Okay. If that's your interpretation of that statute, maybe that's what I need to do. I'm not conceding that's what I need to do, but maybe it is. So we'll file a judgment non-pro-tunk. And he says, well, that's not a proper motion. Well, interestingly, that's the exact motion that they filed in the Metropolitan case. Exact same motion when it was brought to the party litigants' attention in that case when they tried to say that judgment's no good in the Metropolitan case. They filed a motion for judgment non-pro-tunk. And the Court of Appeals said that's the proper thing you should have done. The first judgment was void because it didn't comply with the statute. Therefore, the proper mechanism is to refile that judgment with the commission, let it sit there 30 days, and then have it re-entered by the court, because the court never loses plenary power over a void judgment. So now that's the law. More carriers are like, see, we've been telling you that all along. This is what we need to do. We'll just go down and get another judgment if you don't like that, if we agree with their interpretation. Well, where, then the where nuisance did you, case.
Where,
you just said something that's contrary to what my understanding of the law is. You said court retains plenary power indefinitely over a void judgment.
That's what the Metropolitan case says. Yes, sir.
Unfamiliar with that proposition, law.
I'm sorry.
I'm unfamiliar with that proposition of law that a court retains indefinite jurisdiction over a void judgment.
The Metropolitan case said that a void judgment is a nullity, and therefore, if a court signed something, it was a nullity. It didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, it retains plenary power to correct that indefinitely.
Are you confusing perhaps the concept of nunc-pro-tunc power that a court has to correct a clerical error in a judgment with finality of a judgment? And how would you explain that proposition in considering the policy of the state and the law of the state that there must be finality to judgments at some point?
Yes, sir. And I couldn't agree with you more that there should be finality. And the problem that we're dealing with the fact that in the Metropolitan case, they basically conceded that first judgment was void because it didn't comply with the statute requiring the judgment be sent to the commission, okay?
But a void judgment can become final for appeal purposes. Would you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. But you're saying this void judgment did not become final for appeal purposes?
Correct. It did not. Well, I'm saying that based upon Metropolitan. But now we've got the Brooks case, which is out of the same court that decided the Newsom case. And the Brooks case said, remember, they decided Newsom first, and they said not only was the first judgment void, dealing with the same exact issue, but the second judgment was void because the court lost plenary power over the first judgment. So what they did in Newsom is they sent the whole case back down to the trial court to basically act to enter another judgment. So Newsom really is of no benefit to anybody. It just said first judgment was void because you didn't comply, because, again, the parties conceded that it was void, which I would have never done. And then they said, okay, so that's void. The parties conceded that. The second one's void because the court didn't have plenary power to have the second one. We're going to send them both back down. Well, then out comes Brooks out of the exact same Court of Appeals and says, you know what? We need to relook at this wording of this statute. And they said this statute applies to cases where it wasn't adjudicated. It applies to cases where the parties are agreeing to a judgment, submitting an agreed judgment to the court, or doing a settlement and submitting that to the court. And they're saying, you know, that's the type of thing the commission needs to be aware of. That's the type of thing they need to be able to step in and say, wait a minute, y'all can't do that. But when it's a litigated case and you sent the petition to the commission and you sent a proposed judgment to the commission, and you go down and you try your case, why should the subsequent injury fund then come back on us 8 years later after we've done all this work and say, well, King's X, we're not going to pay you any money?
So for your purposes, it really doesn't matter which judgment is final, because now under Brooks, the first judgment
is not only
gets you
valid,
exactly where you want to be, just as well as the non-pro-tunc.
I will admit the second judgment is not right. What was sent to them in 2004 was the actual judgment that was entered with the court, and then another lawyer went down and got this.
By the second judgment, which date?
The second judgment was entered on October 4th, 2004.
The judgment nunc pro tunc?
Right. Yeah. It is not even close to being the first or the third judgment. I can't explain why Judge Rimmel find that one to be the correct one, but it's really not the correct one because it does grant more relief than we ever requested. We've never, as he said, denied the case in its entirety. It was over extent of injury and disability. And the third judgment, which was also sent to the commission, is identical to the first one. And the actual judgment nunc pro tunc sent to the commission was identical, which, again, is not part of your record, because it's just not sent to the court. It's sent to them first, and then I get my file stamp copy back, put it in my file, then we.
Well, if you're saying that the order on plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on April 10th, 2003 is a final judgment.
Based upon the Brooks case, yes.
And that's what the appellant is saying too, right?
Yes.
So then why are we here?
That's a good question. They filed the appeal. They were going to continue to argue that there's, I guess, Brooks, when I sue them in Travis County when they don't pay me my money, that Brooks is not the law somehow, and that that's a void judgment for their purposes, for purposes of me allowing my firm, my client, to collect the money from the subsequent injury fund.
Sounds like a battle for another day.
It is.
Sounds like something we can decide here in this case.
Yes, sir. But I think a fair finding by this tribunal would be that not only was the first judgment final, but it's also a valid judgment for purposes according to Brooks.
I'm not sure we can do that, Counselor. When the plenary power of the court ended and there was no appeal taken from that judgment, what I'm getting at, for us to have jurisdiction to determine whether that first judgment was valid, there would have had to have been an appeal taken from that judgment.
Yes, sir. I see your point.
But, it can be collaterally attacked if it's a void judgment, but... any event, that's just my view of it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Richards.
Thank you.
Well, very briefly, Your Honors, to answer Justice Walker's question, why are we here? Fair question.
What more is there to say?
It was a situation where I believe, and this is something Mr. Richards and I may agree on, we've been tied in a procedural knot. I really think that Mr. Richards' client could have easily have been the appellant in this case for some of the same reasons that my client is the appellant. We simply want to clean this up, go back to the first judgment, and have it as the final judgment. And then both sides can argue over what the significance of that judgment means when you apply Section 410.258 to it and when they seek reimbursement from the subsequent injury fund, especially in light of the Brooks case.
Is there some type of judicial review from a ruling by the
injury fund?
Yes.
No, ma'am, there is not, except for a declaratory judgment action, where they can seek some clarification as to what the administrator should or should not do in a situation like this. Now, we have arguments. We believe that Brooks is likely not to apply in this case simply because they got a motion for summary judgment based on deemed admissions, which looks more like a default judgment to us than a judgment made by the parties, as the Brooks court argued did not have to be submitted to the commission. We believe judgments such as this need to be shown to the commission simply because, I'm sorry, I'm using the old term, the division of workers' comp, simply because the other party was not present when that judgment was entered. But again, that is for another court in another day, my client would argue. I'd like to rally to Mr. Richards' defense in one respect. I believe he described to the Chief Justice the holding in Metropolitan v. Jackson, which is in his brief. I think that is a description of the holding of MTA versus Jackson. They do appear to be holding that a court retains its plenary power when a statute says the judgment it rendered maybe a couple of years before is void. But there's also another case down in the Houston area that was a First Court of Appeals case, the MTA versus Jackson. There's also the McCoy versus North Forest ISD case, and that site is 2007 Westlaw 5209540, which holds differently, and I think is more in line with the Newsom v. Ballinger's findings that a court's plenary power once it expires, there are only a certain limited number of ways to attack a judgment void. Finally, Your Honors, I don't feel real a need to address the proposed judgment argument. As he pointed out, those judgments are not in the record. My client's position is a proposed judgment submitted to the Division of Workers' Comp should be the judgment that was presented to the judge that he signed, not a judgment that they sent to us well ahead of the lawsuit. And Mr. Richards has acknowledged that the proposed judgment they sent to the Division when they filed their pleadings originally is not the same judgment that the court signed.
What I don't understand about that argument is how does a litigant have any control over what judgment a trial court signs? I mean, how in the world can a litigant ever provide a judgment to someone that hasn't been signed by the trial court? The trial court can cross out, redo, rewrite. I mean, it seems...
Well, in practice, and actually...
Plus, it slows down the disposition, which once the trial courts have decided what they want to do, they want to sign a judgment pronto.
They do indeed, Your Honor. But most judges over the past 13 years have cooperated with both parties and have had the judgment sent to the Division of Workers' Comp for the 30 days. Usually, the practitioner who is most concerned about it sends a copy of a draft judgment asking the judge not to sign it until the 30 days has expired.
And what difference does it make? The division has no standing to object to whatever the judge wants to sign. I mean,
well, what we can do and have done in the past is we will appear in court if we see in something in the judgment that does not comply with the labor code, with the Workers' Comp Act. Sometimes a carrier and a claimant, and this is rare, will make an agreement outside the presence of the court. They'll draft a judgment, or they'll, through their proceedings, lead the court to sign a judgment that doesn't comply with the Workers' Comp Act. And so the legislature placed the division as a possible intervener to make sure that judgments rendered were fair to all parties. Thank you.
So I just want to be clear, both parties in this case, Mr. Richards and Mr. Hayburn, you both agree that the judgment from which this appeal was taken should be vacated and set aside, and recognition of the first judgment as being the only final judgment in this case.
That is my understanding of
it. Is that essentially what...
Based upon the Brooks case,
thank you, counselors.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The case is submitted. Mr. Hayburn, have a safe trip back to Austin. See you, Mr.